During this episode of the Politocrat Daily Podcast, there will be some graphic audio descriptions that you may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Sunday, April the 21st. 2024. On this edition of The Politocrat, a tale of two networks, how CNN and MSNBC covered the horrific event that took place this past Friday on Center Street in New York, a man setting himself ablaze. Plus, the House of Representatives passed some key legislation on Saturday, with aid to Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, and Gaza. Plus, remembering 35 years ago plus this weekend, the Central Park Five, four black boys and one Latino boy rounded up by police on a horrific night of violence in New York Central Park. All of that coming up next.
Sometimes it snows in April. Sometimes I feel so bad, so bad. Sometimes I wish that life was never ending. And all good things they say never last.
All good things they say never last. That was Prince with Sometimes It Snows in April. And here we are, dear listener, on Sunday, April the 21st, 2024. And the reason I play Prince with that song, Sometimes It Snows in April, is because on this day, sadly, 8 years ago, Prince was found non-responsive and he passed away. Very, very sad indeed. It's been 8 years now, exactly 8 years. And that song, especially given its title, especially given this day, is particularly haunting. All good things they say never last. Prince had that right. But Prince, I think, also knew that there are beautiful people and beautiful things that forever remain immortal. And certainly the music that Prince produced, the songs that he wrote, the thousands of songs that he wrote, the thousands of songs that he performed, will be forever immortal and immortalized. They will live forever. And through those songs, Prince himself will live forever. So maybe Prince might want to tweak those lyrics in the hereafter. I'm going to take a break now. Rest in power, Prince. We miss you very much. We still miss you. And, of course, we will forever love you. During this episode of the Politocrat Daily Podcast, there will be some graphic audio descriptions that you may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
An active shooter
is in the park outside the court. We have a man who is lit, he has set fire to himself. A man has emblazoned himself outside of the courthouse just now. Our cameras are turning right now. A man has now lit himself on fire outside of the courthouse in Manhattan, where we are waiting for history to be made. A full jury panel is gone. We are watching a man who is fully emblazoned in the front of the courthouse today. We are watching multiple fires breaking out around his body and person. We have seen an arm that has been visible that has been engulfed in total flames. There is chaos that is happening. People are wondering right now if people are in danger. I'm looking across the courtyard. There is a man racing to his aid. There is coats coming off to try to put out the fire. We have members of security details. NYPD is rushing to the scene. They are trying to come out. Officers are on the scene. A fire extinguisher is right now present being put on this man to try to put out. People are climbing over barricades to try to separate the public to put out the flame on this man. He has lit himself out in fire in front of the courthouse right now. We are watching as the flame. We can smell the air. I can smell the burning of some sort of a flesh. I can smell the burning of some sort of agent being used as well as an accelerant to put that fire. I smell an actual fire extinguisher having been displayed. I see a person whose body appears to be on the ground being surrounded by officers. I have multiple officers. I've counted about a dozen officers on the scene. The fire is still burning. It's now in multiple locations. It continues to blaze. We right now have officers removing their coats trying to surround this person to envelop their body to prevent them from further going into flames. You can smell, I'm sitting here with Evan Perez, you can smell burning flesh, you can smell an accelerant. The flames are continuing to engulf his person. I hear shouts that are coming from across the courtyard. I have people, multiple people running over, another fire extinguisher being brought out. This person's body continues to be engulfed in flames. A portion of his body is still engulfed in flames. A yellow smoke is billowing from on top of his person as it is engulfing the officers who are continuing to try to put out these flames that are continuing to emblazon. Now the officers are not visible through the gulf and the cloud of smoke.
Dear listener, that for me is utterly disgusting. That is not journalism. That is not news. It is not newsworthy. And it doesn't make for good television. It is exploitive. It is deeply disturbing. And it's cruel. It's tantamount to a snuff video. CNN has sunk to ever lower depths. And it's not entirely the fault of Laura Coates. And quite frankly, it really does not matter in my view whether Laura Coates is a legal analyst and attorney, and she is, or whether she is a seasoned journalist, and she's not. The fact that you would be describing something like that as if you are describing and doing play-by-play commentary for the Kentucky Derby is most distasteful and offensive. Far more offensive, however, than that is the decision of the bosses and the editorial folks and the directors at CNN to watch that scene play out live of a human being clearly in mental distress, ending his life right there in front of your very eyes. And those camera persons who made the decision to turn the camera around and show that. And as I said, the CNN bosses and editorial people who made a decision to show that. And the people on the scene in the video, which you heard but didn't obviously see, The people at the scene, I'm going to tell you this right now. There were some people who rushed to the barricade, not to jump over the barricade and help that man in distress, but rushed to the barricade and stayed on the barricade and took photos and took photographs and took video of this man taking his own life via self-immolation, the act of dousing yourself in gasoline and setting flame to yourself. They didn't help. They stood there taking pictures. And yes, in New York and in many other states, it is not a crime to sit and watch somebody burn to death. But I guess it should be. Thank goodness there were people who rushed to help this 30-some-odd-year-old man, Max Azzarello, I think his name was. And I say was because yesterday, Saturday, he passed away. We learned that he passed away from his injuries. And really, after you see a video like this, and I don't recommend that you watch the video that CNN, that has all, that look, it's blanketed social media. How could you not see it if you're a social media person? But really, there would really be nobody who would survive something quite as distressing as that. Now, I did warn you at the top of this episode and at the top of this segment that you would be hearing audio that would be very distressing. And I wanted to play the Laura Coates audio first. Here is how it sounded on MSNBC. Yasmin Vesugian was on the air when this happened. Now again, I'm going to warn you. You may find the contents of the audio that you are about to hear to be disturbing. And at this time, I want to remind you that listener discretion is advised. But there is a contrast in this video from the video you just heard. I want you to listen, dear listener, to the way that Yasmin Vesugian, who is, by the way, a seasoned journalist, handles this episode. I want you to just listen to how she handles seeing this very deeply traumatic event approximately 50 feet away from her.
People in this jury is set. Let me take you through kind of the makeup, Chris, of this jury so we can kind of remind folks who will be really kind of knowing the future of this president, right? We have on this jury right now 7 men and 5 women. That will be the jury that will be in the jury box. Then amongst the alternates, we have 5 women and 1 man. We just added 2 more alternates to the jury box in the last 20 minutes or so. And a jury has, in fact, been impaneled. Let me talk you through some of what these folks do for their vocation. We have a sales worker, an investment banker, an attorney, a security engineer, a teacher, a software engineer, a litigator, a wealth manager, a speech therapist, a product development manager, a physical therapist. That is the jury box. And then we have the alternates. We have an asset manager, someone who is unemployed, an audio professional, a contract specialist, a creative operations for a clothing company, and an estimator, a project manager for a construction company. A really unbelievable moment, Chris, I should say, in that courtroom just now, as they have now impaneled this jury. And by the way, let's remind folks, Chris, how quick this process went, right? Day one, when we were out here, we projected this thing was going to take at least 2 weeks. We thought it would. And in fact, now we are, what, 4 days in, and they have already impaneled a jury. That means that we are looking towards Monday for opening arguments. That is an unbelievable timeline to think about. And I got to say, Chris, now I'm looking at, there is a man on fire, Chris. In the middle of a square in front of me where protesters were standing, an individual has now set himself on fire. And I am looking at this now. We don't have cameras trained on this individual, but it is unbelievable to see, Chris. My gosh.
Is it over in an area yet?
He has now
where
collapsed. He is about 50 feet away from me, Chris. He is now collapsed on the ground. We have security running to this man, trying to put their coat on him to put the flames out. He has set himself on fire and is now shaking, it seems, as the fire is being put out by security personnel who have surrounded this individual. They have now put the fire out, Chris, as this man is just lying there, it seems, having lit himself on fire in this very moment. And I want to reiterate to folks that are watching this, we don't know if this has any connection to what just took place in the courtroom behind us with this jury now being impaneled, but it was an awful sight to see, Chris, that this man setting himself
well,
on
as
fire,
you say, we don't know what happened there, Yasmin. We don't know if this was a suicide attempt.
We don't know.
So let's not, I don't want to speculate, but the headline here, and I'm sorry you had to see that, by the way, what an awful thing for anybody who was down there. But seven men, five women on the main jury, five women, one man on the alternate jury. I want to go back to Paul Butler and pick up on something.
What a difference a news network makes. That was MSNBC on Friday afternoon during the time that this man set himself afire. And Yasmin Vesugian was much different in her response. And I'm sure she was traumatized as well. Obviously, Laura Coates was. And she spoke more about that, about what that was like for her, and admitted that she got the information wrong after the fact. There was not an active shooter going forward. She was caught up in the moment and she was suffering the effects of some trauma there. I mean, that's very clear. And she spoke about that as well. But with Yasmin Vesugian's response, as you heard, was much, much more, I think, respectful in that moment. It's a tricky situation to be in, but really to commentate on this in a way that spells horse race, or literally, like I thought about the Kentucky Derby when I was listening to Laura Coates. Yasmin Vesugian handled this, I think, in the way that you should. And I thought MSNBC at large handled this in the way that you should, which is not to show it. And Yasmin said that, I don't know that we have cameras trained on this. I don't think we do. She didn't appeal for the camera to be trained on it. And there was no decision, obviously, in the MSNBC directors or producers areas to make that something that we should see. And there was no camera person who decided, well, yeah, let me turn the camera on this. There's nothing newsworthy about this. It becomes an exploitation. It becomes a train wreck. It really does become train wreck theater. And when you realize that someone is trying to end their own life, it becomes even more exploitive and distasteful and heinous to not only show those images, but then to have a running commentary on them as if it is some kind of horse race really does demean and make great light and mockery of something very deeply serious and very deeply distressing. And I think MSNBC got it absolutely right. And you heard the anchor, Chris Jansing, saying to Yasmin Vesugian, well, we shouldn't speculate, let's not speculate, which I thought was really good. That's what good journalism is. And then Chris Jansing also apologized to Yasmin Vesugian for having to see that right in front of her in real time. And I thought Yasmin Vesugian did a very good job. That's what journalism is. having the anchor come in and apologize to her as well, that's good journalism. And also saying, well, we really shouldn't speculate on this. We don't know whether it was a suicide attempt or not. And it turned out that it was a suicide attempt. So Chris Jansing was absolutely on the money as a news anchor in that moment. She demonstrated the sensitivity and the empathy and the compassion and the decency and the dignity to mark this event as a traumatic one and also give respect to not only the person who was in that moment trying to end his life, but also to their family, who may, one of their members of their family, may be watching CNN or may be watching MSNBC. And of course, they wouldn't possibly have known that it was their loved one who was trying to end his own life, but they obviously know that by now. And we have to really be careful with how we report news. And I include myself as someone who does a podcast. I have to be careful. If I get something wrong, I have to be able to have it fact-checked and corrected and to convey that to you, dear listener, so that you understand that I actually give a darn about reporting facts and reporting them correctly. I know I would say and I would concede that Laura Coates is in a very difficult position in the sense that, again, I know she's not a journalist per se. But when you see an event, no matter who you are going to react to it if it is extremely traumatic. And you are going to react to it one way or another. You are going to either scream to the top of your lungs and run far away from here. You're going to be calmer, but yet inside you have that trauma that you can't get rid of. You're going to be someone who might behave in the way that Laura Coates did to get her through that traumatic event. But no matter what manner that you behave in, you have a responsibility when you're on the air to cover journalism and do journalism in a fearless way, not in a showcase way. And I think that's where Laura Coates made the mistake, whether unwittingly or not. There just has to be some decency involved in all of this. And again, my larger complaint is really with the CNN editorial board, the CNN producer, the CNN director, whose bright idea it was to keep the camera trained on this, and those camera persons whose bright idea it was to turn the camera on this and see a pretty reasonable close-up of this man dying. It was the most distasteful thing. So there is a fine line, but quite frankly, with this, my thinking has evolved. On Friday, I posted something on X talking about whether or not one should even consider this good television, and I didn't think it was. But I also now think that there has to be some decency around this and respect. This is obviously not newsworthy to cover that in terms of covering that event live. But MSNBC, at least, had the right idea about this, and they were very respectful. CNN, on the other hand, I think they were just trolling for ratings and unwittingly had a reporter, or I should say a legal analyst and lawyer named Laura Coates, in the middle of this. And as you can predict, she caught a lot of hell, pardon the pun. No pun intended, I should say, around this particular story. CNN have got to be better. The editor has got to be better in that moment. The director, the producers have to be better in that moment. And some really strong executive decisions must be made. During this episode of the Politocrat Daily Podcast, there will be some graphic audio descriptions that you may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. I have to play this for you from September 11th, 2001. This was in the evening on MSNBC. Ashley Banfield was reporting live on air in Lower Manhattan, and behind her was a collapsing 7 World Trade Center. The smoke from that collapse, the dust from that collapse, was moving toward her location, several blocks north in Lower Manhattan. Here is how she reacted to that event happening live on air. And I will warn you again that you may find this audio to be disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
Please be careful of your baby. Oh my God. Look behind us. Please pan in this way. Please be careful of your baby. This is it.
That's the building coming down.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. No. No. Listen.
Okay.
We'll be all right. We'll be all right.
We're okay. I think we're okay. Ashley, I think we're okay.
All right. We're going to have to move this way. We're going to have to move. That cloud is coming this way.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it up to you as to how you felt that Ashley Banfield dealt with that situation on September 11th, 2001 in Lower Manhattan in New York City. I will leave that to you. I'm not going to characterize it, but there are ways, in my view, that you report on things like this, and everyone is going to be different. Now, Ashley Banfield is a veteran journalist. She is now on News Nation, and she's received a lot of criticism for a number of different things during the course of her journalistic news career. All I am doing in playing the audio that you just heard is give you a listen to how someone else dealt with a traumatic situation, and surely seeing a building collapse and seeing the cloud of dust and smoke from that building rumble toward you is a traumatic situation. Everyone deals with these things differently. And I will leave it to you to make an assessment, obviously, as to which situation was dealt with in a way that you feel more comfortable. Not necessarily which was better, although you could, I'm sure you will reach a conclusion on that one way or another. But really, which situation was dealt with in a way that was most comfortable for you? Because for me, I have a very clear answer, and I've already tipped my hat as far as that is concerned.
On this vote, the yeas are 366 and the nays are 58. The bill is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
And that was the announcement yesterday of the House vote of 366 to 58 to send $26.4 billion of aid to Israel. Now, this is how it breaks down. $17 billion of that $26.4 billion will go to Israel for offensive and defensive weaponry. And the remainder of that money, which would be the $9.4 billion, will go to Gaza, and it will be in the form of humanitarian aid. And it will also stretch beyond Gaza to any other parts of the region where Palestinian people have been killed or affected in any other measure. I just find it fitting that roughly two-thirds, if not more, of that aid goes to Israel for offensive and defensive weaponry, much of which is being used, a lot of which is being used against Palestinians. I think it's really telling where a government's head is when most of the aid that it votes for is dedicated to weaponry. Now, granted, Israel is an ally of the United States, but it is very telling to me that Israel gets more money for defensive and offensive weaponry, while Gaza and the Palestinian people who, look, over 34,000 Palestinian people have been killed in Gaza. It just strikes me as kind of odd, and forgive my facetiousness, that Gaza would only be getting $9 billion in humanitarian aid. I find that odd. Let's just put it that way. But the bottom line is that the bill passed in the House yesterday. This coming Tuesday, the Senate will vote on this bill and it will pass. There's no question about it. Now, by the way, I should point out the no votes. There were 37 Democrats who voted against this bill. Voted against the bill. Because they voted on the basis that, at least many of them voted on the basis that Israel should not be getting this kind of aid given what's happening to the Palestinians. And given what the Israeli government has done to the Palestinians. So that, for me, is something that should not be forgotten. It just shouldn't be forgotten, you know? I just think that that is very, very clear. But the bottom line is that 37 Democrats voted no and 21 Republicans voted no. So there you have it. That is how that broke down for that bill. Now, the other thing I want to point out to you is that there were other votes yesterday as well. And the other vote yesterday that also was significant, and there's several of them that were significant. One of them was the aid to Ukraine, and that was a separate vote. That vote finished 311 to 112 with one congressperson voting present. So that was a $66.0 billion aid package to Ukraine. So that was a significant vote. More Democrats voted for the bill than Republicans did. And it broke down as 210 Democrats and 101 Republicans voting yes. So it was 210 Democrats voting yes and 101 Republicans voting yes. And there were 112 Republicans who voted no. Every Democrat voted yes. And 112 Republicans voted no. So more Republicans voted no than yes for this bill. So that is that as far as the Ukraine bill is concerned. Again, the Senate will vote on that on Tuesday, and that will pass. And of course, by the way, there was a note sent on X, on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, by the Ukraine president, Volodymyr Zelensky, and he was very thankful, as you can imagine, for receiving that aid, for getting that aid. And apparently there have been some published news reports on KCBS radio here in San Francisco that have said that the aid, and also this is also on Face the Nation, a CBS news program, the aid could reach Ukraine as soon as the end of this week, once it gets passed on Tuesday and once it gets signed by President Biden. That's a really quick turnaround. So by Tuesday, once this gets passed in the Senate and gets signed that same day by President Biden, the aid could be in Ukraine as soon as Friday, which I think is phenomenal. But there you go. That is how that went. And then there were a couple of other votes. There was a vote in favor of aid to Taiwan and Indochina, if you will, Indo-Pacific region, in the Indo-Pacific region, I should say, I'm sorry about that, Indo-Pacific region and Taiwan. And that vote went 385-34-1. And the one was Representative Rashida Tlaib, who voted present. 34 Republicans, the 34 who were no's, were all Republicans. They voted against this measure. It was a bill that would send about $8.1 billion of aid to countries in the Indo-Pacific region, including Taiwan. So that was the bill that went and got passed yesterday in the House, 385-34-1. 385 yeses, 34 noes, all Republican noes on that in 34. And then the one person voting present was the Democrat, Rashida Tlaib, the representative out of Michigan. And then there was bill on TikTok that got passed as well. 360-58. Now, this bill by the House was a bill that expressly said that the owners of TikTok, ByteDance, B-Y-T-E, dance, ByteDance, they own TikTok. Now, the bill requires ByteDance to sell TikToks within, to sell TikTok within 9 months. And it also allows for the seizure of Russian assets. So, under this bill, which the Senate is, we'll see if the Senate pass it. They should pass this bill in the Senate as well on Tuesday. What will happen is, once this gets signed, and President Biden will sign this. As you know, the government, the U.S. government, does not allow for any of its employees to have TikTok on their phones. That is a requirement. So that's another thing. But the bottom line here, dear listener, is that within 9 months, ByteDance must sell TikTok. If it does not, then TikTok will be banned in the United States. No one will be able to use it. By the way, I don't use TikTok. Maybe you do, but I do not, never have used it, and do not plan to. There's never even, beyond everything with China and what people say about that, I've just never fought it. You know, I've just never had any affinity to use it, although I know people say that it's supposedly this is really quick and convenient, but I've never used it in terms of having it installed or having it or ever using it. So I've never sought fit to do that. So anyway, that is a roundup of the bills. I guess one thing I want to say about that beyond the bills is that the Speaker of the House, the Republican, the right winger, Mike Johnson, who is a conservative Republican and a radical Republican, was taking a modified or modest victory lap yesterday in front of the cameras and the microphones, and the press kind of throffed him up, you know, boosted him. Oh, he's done the right thing, which he has. He did the right thing, obviously. But, you know, my goodness, let's not lionize Speaker Johnson. You know, oh, he may lose his job. And I mean, gee whiz. And if he loses a job, join the club. I mean, there's lots of people on the planet who've lost their jobs. I've lost my job at one point in my life. You've lost your job in one point in your life at one point. I mean, let's not sit here now and lionize somebody. And I kind of sense that some of the press yesterday was doing a little bit of that. Well, he could lose his job, and this is a noble thing that he did. You know, he's just doing the job he's supposed to do. If you do your job right as Speaker in this one instance, Mike Johnson, yeah, you know, that's what you should be doing. Let's not give anyone, I don't care which party they're in, any undue praise, extra praise, for doing something that they're supposed to do. I mean, again, it's kind of like what Daniel Patrick Monaghan said in the day, back in the day, about lowering the bar. Mark Elias of Democracy Docket has written about this too, this idea that we lower the bar for something that everybody should be doing in their job in the positions that we are lowering the bar for. I mean, let's not lower the bar. We don't do this for Democrats. We seem to do this for Republicans all the time. When they do something that actually is correct for a change, I guess that we're quick to find heroes in this country. I've said this a lot over the years, that we in the United States rush to find heroes, sometimes where they're really not needed to be found and where it's not necessary for them to be found. That's the same kind of thing. I've just repeated it. But We do that a lot in this country, especially when it comes to Republican politicians, and especially when it comes to white Republican politicians, especially when it comes to white male Republican politicians. We always rush in this country. This culture in this country rushes to find a hero. Oh, well, Mike Johnson, he's risking losing his job. He's standing up to these radical Republicans. Well, he's one of them. That's the thing. He's radical. He's as radical as Marjorie Taylor Greene is. He just doesn't say a lot of the garbage and the BS that she says publicly. He just doesn't say it publicly necessarily. Sometimes he does, but he doesn't say stupid things like Jewish space lasers, anti-Semitic garbage like that. He doesn't say those kinds of things. Now, he probably has a number of the beliefs that MTG has, and MTG is a toxic piece of trash. She really is trash. And the fallacy is that somehow Mike Johnson isn't the same. But he is. And I think he's far worse in a lot of ways. So, look, the bottom line is that let's not, in the corporate news media, make this big meal out of Mike Johnson doing the right thing. You know, we love to do that when it comes to white male politicians. Oh, yes. Oh, you did the right thing. And then when a black female politician does it, she doesn't get any attention. And quite frankly, she isn't seeking the attention. And I don't know if Mike Johnson is or not, but he's been in front of the cameras lately, hasn't he? I mean, look, I know he's the Speaker of the House, so he's going to have to come before the cameras. But again, as I said, I think more recently, in an episode on this podcast, if not before then, or in other fora, this is the same Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, the same far right winger who was at Mar-a-Lago just about a week ago or so, kissing the ring of an orange traitor. So, you know, let's not forget that. We have a really selective memory in this country about things. We've already forgotten that I'm not even going to call him president. We've already forgotten that the orange traitor tried to get Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, who I've talked about earlier, to try to smear then Vice President Joe Biden. We've already forgotten that. We've already forgotten, many of us, that that's what the orange trash bag was impeached for the first time around. People have forgotten that already. Ooh, what was that? What was he impeached for? Same thing the second time. I think people barely remember that orange traitor was impeached the second time and impeached for insurrection and spurring on a domestic terrorist attack on the United States of America and symbolically on and actually on the U.S. Capitol. That's what he was impeached for the second time around. But again, we have a very collectively short memory as Americans. We don't remember 2 seconds ago. Do you remember what I said 2 seconds ago, dear listener? But David Bowie sang about this literally about 40 years ago in the song Young Americans. And I've repeated that line a number of times. But this time, I will leave it to David.
Do you remember your President Nixon? Do you remember the bills you have to pay? Or even yesterday? Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer.
Yes, Nina Simone there with Mississippi Goddamn. That was from 1964, by the way. That's 60 years ago. live at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Yes, Nina Simone there. And the reason I play that for you, dear listener, is that this also happens to be the day that Nina Simone passed away. April the 21st. 21 years ago on this day. 21 years ago today, Nina Simone passed away. In fact, I had actually not remembered that. I had not known that, quite frankly. And a social media post that I had come across from Nina Simone's estate, at Nina Simone Music. That is the post, that is the account on X or Twitter, if you prefer. And they posted a really lovely picture of Nina Simone. She was such a beautiful person and a beautiful woman. And any picture of Nina Simone is beautiful. I never had seen this particular photo of her before. And wow. Just absolutely beautiful, as she always was and still is, even though she's no longer with us. Nina Simone was an activist. You know, I think that she probably would like to be remembered as an activist, even more than the multi-talented, multi-faceted, multi-skilled and self-taught musician that she was. Nina Simone taught herself the piano at the age of 4 or 5. I mean, you know, she was excellence personified, someone who sang a lot of standards, a lot of ballads, and a lot of different things, but also did some of her own work as well, wrote her own stories, I should say, and wrote her own songs at times, and sang her own songs. So Nina Simone was a multi-skilled, multi-talented, brilliant artist, and she was an activist, a fervent activist, someone who strongly believed in Black people and in the upliftment of Black people and justice for Black people and freedom for Black people. She was someone who was resolute about that at a time where there were a lot of Black artists who weren't necessarily resolute about that. And Nina Simone stood tall and faced a lot of heat, faced a lot of anti-Black sentiment, racism, misogyny, went through a lot of difficult things in her life as well. Some of that is chronicled in the documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone? What Happened, Miss Simone? Question mark. A documentary that was directed by Liz Garbus. And really a good documentary, very thorough, and also quite troubling at times as well. And Nina Simone was someone who, again, really had authenticity and integrity about her as a person, as an artist, as an activist. And look, the bottom line is that Nina Simone believed in Black people, and Nina Simone championed Black love, championed Black self-love, championed Black people being who they are in their at their very essence, at their core. And celebrated Blackness. That was Nina Simone. And that's the part of Nina Simone that I don't think gets, surprise, surprise, gets played in white corporate news media. It doesn't. And Nina Simone had to flee to Paris to get away from all the stress and all the pain of the racism in the United States that was invected at her. And all of the white people in the United States who hated her for standing tall and standing up and standing as who she was as a person and speaking truth to power, which is what Nina Simone did, by the way. She did not ever get to meet Malcolm X or Dr. King, but she was someone who was fervently aligned with the civil rights movement, the human rights movement, the Black liberation struggle. She was very clear about that. She was clear about that in her music. She was clear about that outside her music. And Mississippi Goddamn was just one of the songs in which she really talked about that. And there was a, and by the way, this is also in the documentary that won the Oscar a few years ago, the documentary by Questlove. Now, all of a sudden, I've forgotten, I think it's called Summer of Soul, that won a year or two ago, about 2 years ago now. You remember infamously, that was the award that was given out at the Oscars directly after the Will Smith and Chris Rock contretemps. Questlove had directed a documentary called Summer of Soul. And if you watch that documentary, you will see Nina Simone during one of her concerts talking very clearly about Black empowerment. And I thought that was just a really profoundly good thing. I really, really love that about Nina Simone, you know? And if you look at the photos of her back in the 60s and into the 70s, but particularly in the 1960s, where she wore all black and just, you know, she was just, I would have put her as an honorary member of the Black Panthers, because, and I don't know if she ever got to meet the Black Panthers. I have not studied on it, so I don't know. And excuse my ignorance, dear listener, but I can tell you that Nina Simone believed in black people. You know, she was not someone who would ever fail to speak up and speak out. You have a lot of black artists and people who are in the limelight and the spotlight these days, some black celebrities who will not say a word about black liberation, who will not say a word about the injustices thrown at black people, who will not say a thing about it all, would not say a darn word. And here we have the likes of someone like Nina Simone, who was fearless. I mean, that's a really good word I would use for her as well. Fearless in her advocacy for black people. And so on this day, a solemn day, as we hear on this April 21st of 2024, stop to remember Nina Simone. And not just today, but every day. But this was the day 21 years ago that she passed away. And it's sad that she's not here. I really do believe that she died of a broken heart. And it's just sad that she is not here anymore. And you can think of all the prolific songs, all the songs that she did, the standards that she sang. Her rendition of them were often better, very, very much so, often better than the originals. And you can just think of the tunes like Wild is the Wind. You can think of the tunes like Love Me or Leave Me. You can think of the tunes like Exactly Like You. You can think of the tunes like, I mean, I can go on and on and on. And she, of course, did songs like I Ain't Got No Life. I Ain't Got No, I Got Life, I should say. She wrote the song, or at least one of her band members wrote the song. And maybe she wrote it as well, alongside him. I forget his name. The song on Dr. King, and Dr. King passed away. I should say, pardon me, not when he passed away, but when he was assassinated. Let me just get that correct. He did not pass away. He was assassinated. He was murdered. He was executed. And so Nina Simone, about 2 days after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968, wrote and performed, I should say, the song Why the King of Love is Dead. And I've played pieces of that from time to time on this podcast. And Nina Simone has got a wealth, a treasure trove of songs that you can listen to, whichever platform or whichever means by which you listen. Vinyl is the best. Whether it's CD for you, vinyl for you, or streaming for you, there is an oasis of songs from Nina Simone. You can go to her website, which is ninasimone.com, if I remember correctly, and purchase her music. I've got a load of her music, and I'm going to be purchasing some more of it, particularly on this day, and playing some of her music on this day. So, Nina Simone, rest in power always. We love you, Nina.
I think what you're trying to ask is, why am I so insistent upon giving out to them that blackness, that black power, that black pushing them to identify with black culture? I think that's what you're asking. I have no choice over it. In the first place, to me, we are the most beautiful creatures in the whole world, black people. I mean, and I mean that in every sense, outside and inside. And to me, we have a culture that is surpassed by no other civilization, but we don't know anything about it. So again, I think I've said this before in this same interview, I think at some time before, my job is to somehow make them curious enough or persuade them by hook or crook to get more aware of themselves and where they came from and what they are into and what is already there, and just to bring it out. This is what compels me to compel them. And I will do it by whatever means necessary.
During this episode of the Politocrat Daily Podcast, there will be some graphic audio descriptions that you may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
I want us to remember what happened that day and be horrified by ourselves.
New York in the late 1980s was a completely schizophrenic, divided city.
New York's now the capital of racial violence.
If I had more bullets, I would have shot them all again and again.
Criminality, gang wars, drug wars. We were supposed to be afraid. It would have been irrational not to be afraid.
Off with the camera, man!
Last night, a woman jogger was found unconscious and partially clothed in Central Park. She was beaten and sexually assaulted.
A woman jogging in Central Park. Central Park was holy. It was the crime of the century.
Five youths were arrested at 96th Street, all between 14 and 15 years of age.
They got them!
You can only imagine the pressure to have this crime solved and solved quickly.
First we was all together, then they started to put us in different rooms separately.
What did you do? Who were you with? Who did you come with?
The tone was very scary. I felt like they might take us to the back of the precinct and kill us.
You're not gonna go home until you give up a story.
I told my son, go to the park that night. I feel guilty.
I'm telling the guy, I don't know what you're talking about. They're getting a little angry.
And they're like, you know, you did it, didn't you?
He had been interrogated for over 24 hours. That amounts to pressure.
These young men were guilty. It was almost unquestioned.
The police controlled the story. They created the story.
They seized on the fears of the people, wilding the bestial characterization of the black man.
There's no DNA match whatsoever to any of these boys.
I was going nuts. No blood on the kids. Nobody could identify them. But if they confessed, they confessed, and that was that.
A lot of people didn't do their jobs. Reporters, police, prosecutors, defense lawyers. This was institutional protectionism.
We falsely convicted them, and we walked away from our crime.
Dear listener, welcome back. And on this April 21st, yeah, it's quite a solemn day when you consider both Nina Simone and Prince passed away on this very date in history. I mean, 8 years ago, it was Prince, and 21 years ago, it was Nina Simone. April the 21st. Well, I do want to also actually conclude this episode with something that happened 35 years ago. Make that 35 years and 2 days ago. With five boys in Central Park in New York City. Five boys, four of them black, one of them Latino. Five boys who were just minding their own business, really, were in Central Park. I think one of them wasn't even in Central Park, actually, at the time. And that's the person that ended up spending the most time behind bars. That's what's so egregious about this. But anyway, April the 19th, 1989 was a horrific night for several people. One of them, of those people, or one of those people was a woman, a white woman, who was savagely attacked and beaten and brutalized and violated by a single perpetrator, a man named Matias Reyes. Now, we didn't know this at the time, but that woman, whose name is Trisha Miley, was jogging in Central Park at night, late at night, on a Wednesday night in New York, in Central Park, and she was brutalized so savagely and so horrifically that, A, she can't remember to this very day what happened to her, and B, she was close to death. Now, that's one thing that happened that was extremely horrific. The other thing that happened that was horrific in a different way was that many boys were rounded up in Central Park who were black or brown. And these five boys in particular were rounded up for actually some other things that were going on in Central Park that night. In fact, the things that were going on in Central Park that night were happening either before, during, or after what happened to Trisha Miley in the park. And so these five boys were amongst up to 50 or 60 boys who were black or brown who were rounded up by the NYPD in that park that night up in East Harlem or thereabouts, Central Harlem or thereabouts. And so while they were rounded up in the park, they were held in the precinct after that. And during the time they were held in the precinct, news got around to the precinct about a woman who had been savagely attacked. That would be Trisha Miley. And the police decided to turn their attention onto that crime and start to question the boys that they had initially arrested for harassing passers-by in the park, harassing bicyclists in the park, and throwing rocks at people in the park. And all of which these five boys did not have anything to do with either, by the way. And they started to question these boys about this savage and horrific crime against a white female jogger. Horrible crime. Anyone, whether it was a white female jogger or a black female jogger or an Asian female jogger or a Latina female, you know, jogger. I mean, it's a horrific crime. Savage, brutal, violent crime. And so these five boys, and one of them was as young as 13 or 14, the eldest, I think, was 16 or 17. They were all being questioned by police about a crime that happened after they were arrested or during the time they were arrested. And so they were sat in a precinct for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours without their parents present for a lot of that, without being allowed to go to the bathroom. Some of those boys, or many of those boys, were intimidated, beaten. Food was withheld from them for over 24 hours. Water was withheld from them. I mean, this was a different kind of brutal treatment. Obviously, I'm not trying to ever compare it to the savage acts of violence that were perpetrated against Trisha Miley. I'm not trying to do that. But there was a different kind of hell that night for those boys, and then for many years to come, because these boys would then be convicted of a crime they didn't commit, and they would spend years of their lives in jail, ranging from around 5 years in prison to 14 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. And then in the early, I guess it was in the early 2010s, they ended up getting a lawsuit successfully through, and they ended up being awarded monies. Now, in 2002 or thereabouts, Matias Reyes came forward and confessed to actually being the one who committed these violent acts against Trisha Miley. One older Latino man who was probably like 26 or so when he confessed and did those crimes when he was 26. And he came forward. By the way, there was never any DNA on these boys. And these boys were, at the time, known as the Central Park Five. Many people in New York believed that they were guilty, including a number of black people. I was one of the few people who felt that they were not guilty at all of any of these crimes. I actually got to know, briefly, some of the family members of some of these boys, especially the Richardson family. Spoke to them regularly, just said hello to them and things like that. That was the extent of the speaking to. I went to court in support of them. I took time out of what I was doing to do that and support them on a number of days. Was there when the verdict was read out against them, Kevin Richardson, and I think the other brother that was with them, because there were two different trials, and they were found guilty, and we all absolutely lost it. Tears, anger, you know, we knew that these boys were innocent. There was no DNA evidence on them. There was no blood on their clothes, nothing from such a savage, violent attack, bloody attack. Trisha Miley lost a lot of her blood. I don't even want to get into how graphic But the bottom line is that for someone who lost as much, forgive me, as much blood as she lost, there's no way that it wouldn't be on the clothing of anybody who perpetuated that attack. And so these boys had no blood on them, and yet they were still convicted. Why? Because these jurors, I think, swayed to the media, who in New York were obsessive about these boys, who called them the most vile things, called them everything but a child of God, called them wolves, called them a wolf pack, called them animals, called them everything. You had that piece of orange garbage putting out newspaper ads in four New York newspapers calling for the death penalty to be brought back in New York to lynch these five boys from the highest tree. You had Pat Buchanan writing similar trash and racist garbage in the New York Post. I mean, it was the most racist, anti-black racist stuff that you could expect from white men and white women who were writing this kind of trollop in New York newspapers and beyond. In fact, across America and across the world, there was this news of this violent attack and these innocent boys, and the world thought, for all intents and purposes, that they were guilty of these crimes. And later on, when we knew for sure that they weren't, and when I felt all along that they weren't, we then got Matias Reyes later on, who had actually killed somebody on the Upper East Side and killed that person, who was a pregnant woman, by the way, on top of that, and did some horrific things, violent things. And he ended up being released. And while he was released, he committed this horrible crime against this jogger. And so the media would spend a lot of time exalting the woman who couldn't remember anything and exploiting her, in my view, for that kind of emotional push, particularly since it was a white woman who was savagely beaten. I think the corporate news media did some really despicable things. They reported this as more than a story. They reported this as, this is your daughter that was attacked. That's basically the tact that I took, that I felt that they took, rather, from what happened to Trisha Miley. And they made her some kind of, you know, martyr, quite frankly. And I don't know that she was thinking that she wanted any of that, because of my impression is that I don't think, you know, based on what she said afterwards, years later, she didn't want to be put in the spotlight. That she ended up coming forward years later, wrote a book, and talked about the horrific things that happened to her. And I think the press actually, in some cases, I think the press actually exploited her, you know. And they certainly denigrated these boys to a point where they could not move anywhere. Their addresses and names and their phone numbers were published in the newspapers. Kid you not. In places like the New York Post, I think, they published their names and their addresses. And these are minors, but that didn't stop their names from coming out, you know. 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, they're all minors. But that didn't stop the New York media from splashing their names all over the place and splashing their addresses all over the place. You know, you've got white boys who are going out here killing people, and they're minors, and their names aren't put out there. You got white boys who are, you know, maybe 19 or 20, who aren't minors, right? But their names aren't put out there either sometimes. Oh, we're withholding their names. You know, I mean, you know, it's just evil. I mean, Adam Lanza, when he killed 26 people in Sandy Hook in 2013, his name was not known for at least 12 hours, if I'm not mistaken. And he was 19 years old, I think, or 20 years old. White male. You know, and that's the way that the white privilege, the white male privilege, and the racism and the whiteness and the corporate news media and the institutionalized racism in it and in this country and on this planet operates. But all of that is to say, dear listener, that these young boys became men the hard way, and became ultimately, in a really good sense, the Exonerated Five. And the Exonerated Five have now gone on to live now varied lives and still a lot of challenges. But I think that these young men now have really grown into their lives and are inspiring people the world over with their courage. People like Dr. Yusuf Salam, one of those convicted, has gone on to become a city councilman. He was recently stopped by police, by the way, in New York, I think it was. New York City police stopped him and tried to, you know, get him into trouble. But Dr. Salam is someone who is a congressman, a city councilman in New York now. Raymond Santana advocates on behalf of people who are unjustly convicted, as does Corey Wise. Raymond Santana, by the way, also has a clothing line and has his own business. Kevin Richardson, I think, the same, has his own business. Antoine McRae is someone who is much more reserved from the spotlight and still, as you can understand, frankly, is still very deeply hurt and furious about what has happened to him and the people in his life who gave up on him. And he talked about this, and he's talked about it quite a bit, and he takes a different approach, and I completely empathize with him. I have not been in his shoes, but I can empathize with him and try to put myself there. But of course I can't relate directly to him because I've not gone through what he's gone through. So it's different for everybody, but I just want to say that these five young men now are living their lives. And again, while the challenges remain, I think that these five young lads are inspiring. And I just wanted to talk about that for a few minutes here as we remember 35 years and 2 days ago, a very horrific time for one particular jogger and also for these five boys and their families. And some of their family members have passed away in this intervening time. And it's just a very sad thing. I am left, however, with courage and with inspiration for what these five boys have become. Five men, five young men who have families and who raise children and who stand tall and who advocate for other people who have been in their particular position. And so I want to thank each of these young boys who are now young men. I want to thank each and every one of them for their courage, their example, and their inspiration. It certainly can't have been easy. And I just want to say that they have come out on the other side of all of this and definitely are standing taller than ever before. Thank you very much, dear listener, for listening to this episode. April 21st. Yeah, it's in terms of the people I've spoken about on this episode, particularly Nina Simone and Prince, two legends, two all-time greats and two geniuses. Somewhat solemn. I do hope you enjoy your day. And I do hope that whenever you're listening to this, dear listener, that you are having a good day. And this is one of those kinds of days, isn't it? Anyway, I do hope that you are well. And I do hope that you did take something out of listening to what you've just listened to today. Quite a bit to digest here on this edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast. Don't forget, you can find this podcast on numerous podcasting platforms, including Apple, Spotify, and Google. You can find yours truly on X at the Popcorn REEL. I'm also on Fanbase, by the way, fanbaseapp.com/ Popcorn REEL. That's fanbaseapp.com/ Popcorn REEL. The YouTube channel, of course, youtube.com/@ Politocrat POD. And of course, as you know by now, it's the Politocrat POD, I'm sorry. And as you know by now, of course, the store itself, the-politocrat.myshopify.com. Thank you very much for listening. to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.
Joining me now is Yusuf Salam. He is one of the men wrongfully convicted in the Central Park jogger case, later exonerated by DNA evidence. And Mr. Salam, first, how old were you when you were arrested, and how much time do you spend in prison?
I was 15 years old when this happened, and I've spent about 7 years in prison, close to 7 years.
Before we get to Donald Trump, I mean, what was it like to go into the system at that age and spend your formative adolescent, early adult years in prison for something you did not do?
You know, to go to prison for a crime like that, that's the absolute worst crime that you can go to prison for. I mean, the only crime that trumps rape is child molestation. And I remember early on, they had these polls that they were doing. They kept saying, you know, what are the inmates going to do when these guys get to prison? You know, untold horrors were mentioned, and we were scared to death. This was a situation where we had to grow up very, very quickly. We had to figure out how we were going to survive and fend for our lives. It was the most horrific event I could have ever imagined.
And so what is your reaction to a man who is trying to be the most powerful person in the world, arguably, who is on the precipice of possibly being president, saying now, in the last day, issuing a statement that you, despite all evidence, that you are guilty?
You know, when I think about what he represents, and I mean, first of all, what he represents to me is very, very powerful and unfortunate. This blight, this thing that he did to us, calling for the reinstatement of the death penalty, I always think that had this been the 1950s, we would have become modern-day Emmett Till's. They had published our names, our phone numbers, and our addresses in New York City's newspapers. And so what was happening was people began to call us at any time of the day or night, you know, threaten us with hate mail and things of that nature. So by Donald Trump taking out this ad, what I think is that he was really calling to see if there was somebody from the darker enclaves of society that would kick in our doors, drag us from our homes, and hang us from trees in Central Park. That's the kind of sick type of justice that they were looking for.
To be clear, this ad, which ran that he paid for, was basically calling for the death penalty for the assailants in this case, who at that point had been identified as juveniles, you among them, basically saying, we should kill these children.
Right, right. You know, he wanted us dead. You know, when you look at the videotapes that he made after, the statements that he made after that, it's very, very clear that he said that he wanted to hate us. He wanted us to be afraid. And by us, he was talking directly about the Central Park Five. But he was talking about also the black and brown people that we look at that being shot down all around the country today. You know, if he's saying that he wants to be the law and order president, and he's talking about policies and practices that have been ruled unconstitutional and unjust, that being stop and frisk in New York City, and he's talking about he wants to bring this type of stuff back, I mean, I'm scared for my life. What happens if this person actually becomes president? Is he going to then go gunning for the Central Park Five because he wanted to murder us back in 1989, and he wants to maybe the same thing to happen to us today? I mean, when we won the lawsuit, one of the things that he said was, this was the biggest heist. This was the biggest heist in New York City history. He said that we were going to be rich rapists. And then all of a sudden now we have these video footage of him being produced, of him doing all of these, you know, I just tweeted prior to getting on. I said, this is a dirty old man,
yeah.
You know, definitely not somebody that we want to be the president of these United States. The type of issues that he presents overwhelmingly causes us, and we need to push far, far away from him.
Mr. Salam, let me quickly, do you feel he owes you an apology?
I feel he owes us an apology. Do I feel like we will ever get it? I think if I held my breath and waited for him to give us an apology, I would probably pass out and turn blue in the face.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. Yusuf Salam, thank you so much, sir, for your time tonight. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.